anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course, that's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course, we want to play at the weekend.
Hello there, Golf Weekly friends. You're very welcome along to the podcast. It's Joe here. A slightly different proposition for you today. I am on my own, abandoned in every sense. So through a combination of holidays and work and various things, people are not around. That said, I've tried to cobble together something for you. So a bit different to the usual format, but maybe lots of good reaction to Ricky Elliott last week. Brooks Koepka's caddy, and it was a very good interview. He was really good. So if you didn't catch that, well worth checking out. Gives a really good insight even into Brooks Koepka's game and trying to caddy for such a big hitter. Things like just how different the yardages are for different irons, much bigger than with shorter hitters, all that kind of stuff. So for the golf nerds out there, that is one to get stuck into. The centerpiece of today's show will be Mo Norman. A legendary figure, I'm sure. If you've done a deep dive on YouTube, as we all have in our golf nerdism, you've come across Mo Norman hitting balls. So more on that in a moment. Obviously, this week, Memorial. We're in Muirfield in Ohio. It's Jack's tournament, 46th time holding the Memorial tournament, Jack Nicklaus. Tiger in the field, Rory in the field. Tiger, a 5-time winner there. Knows his way around that course. Now, of course, on major number 15, Jack doing his press conference. Guess what Jack is having to talk about now, nonstop? Tiger Woods.
I've always felt like, Tiger, before he won at Augusta, he has another 10 years of major championships. He had another 40 major championships in front of him that he would be playing. People say, well, he'll never win another one. I said, well, you guys, don't count him too out. You've heard me say this in the press room. I said, don't count him out. I says, he won major championships hitting it all over the world off the tee. He never has driven it really well. Even when he was winning his teams, he's driving the ball well now. So it's a huge, huge difference for him. And he's always been a great iron player. That's not going to change. He's always had a great, he's always chipped well. He always putts well. If you had a putt to make, it's 10 feet and you need somebody to make it, I think I'd go call Tiger. Hey, Tiger, come make this 10 footer for me. I need it. And he said, he'll make it. He's that kind of competitor. So, I didn't think it made that much difference what had happened to him once he sorted himself out mentally. And once he believed that he could play again, he would win. And like from my standpoint, nobody wants their records broken. I don't want him to break my records, but I don't want him not to be able to play, and not be physically sound to play. I mean, if he's physically sound and his desire to win and he breaks it, well done. That's what it should be. That's what sport's all about to me. And he's done a great job, and I wish it more power to him. I don't have any problem with any of that. So, I thought he might play really well at Bethpage, although he coming off the win, as emotional as a Masters was for him. I think it's understandable that would happen. I don't think he's going to let that happen again. I think that was a wake-up call again for him. And I expect him to play very well this week.
Interestingly, he was asked about Tiger chasing down Sam Snead's 82 tournaments. And it was quite striking. Jack was just pretty dismissive of it. He's like, it's a good achievement and everything. But he said, honestly, nobody knows how many tournaments we all had back in the day. He said, like, general places, they've no idea how many tournaments I've won. Sometimes the PGA Tour give you tournaments, sometimes they take them away. So, he said, nobody knows how many tournaments Sam Snead has won. May have won more, may have won less. Obviously a good achievement and everything, but he said, you ask Tiger what record he wants, it's the major one. Rory McIlroy is there. Rory popped up in a story in Golf Digest this week. It seems Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson were among the players who considered a boycott of the US Open. The USGA have made a mess of things, frankly. 2015, Chambers Bay was a bit funny. The greens like broccoli, according to Henrik Stenson. Then 2016, with Shane Lowry in the hunt, the Dustin Johnson fiasco over whether or not his ball had oscillated, whether he was being penalised a shot, and he played the back nine, not actually knowing what score he was on. So in Golf Digest this week, in one of these on the basis of anonymity survey questions. One PGA Tour player, winner of multiple titles, said, "We had about 10-15 guys who were willing to sit out the US Open after 2016. Some of them were big names. Dustin was one, Rory was another." The player said, "I was prepared to do it, absolutely. I figure we needed 25 guys, and I think we could have gotten there based on what I was hearing from the players." Pretty interesting story. USGA making a mess of things, frankly, a bit over the last couple of years. So Rory at Memorial didn't really confirm or deny that story as such, but did give his thoughts on Pebble Beach and the USGA and what the US Open should be. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I feel like I've got a pretty pretty good relationship. They've set up like a player liaison team over the past couple of years, Jenny Pritchard and Robbie Zalesnik, and I've had pretty good dialogue with them back and forth. Do they seek our opinion? Yeah, just like some of the other tournaments do. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously guys from the USGA here this week. They're trying to do as good a job as they can, and you know, I think they'll admit that they've made a couple of mistakes over the past few years, but you know, everyone does, and you know, I think we should give them the chance to redeem themselves. And you know, if they can't redeem themselves at Pebble Beach, then there could be a problem.
Should they seek your opinion?
What's that?
Should they seek your opinion?
But I think they do. But opinion on what? On how to run the golf tournament or how to set the golf course up? I mean, what, you know, I don't run golf tournaments and I don't set golf courses up. So I think they should seek the opinion of people that do that every week. But I mean, I guess in my head, growing up watching US Opens, that was what my perception of a US Open was. It was tight fairways, it was thick rough, it was a premium on accuracy and precision. And I think some of the golf courses we played and some of the setups over the past couple of years have went a little bit away from that. And I've said to them, we play one Open Championship a year, we don't need to play two. You know, like, the, you know, I think it's just lost its identity a little bit in terms of what it is. And I'd like to just see them go back to that, because it worked. It really worked.
Hard to argue. So that's Rory. Tiger's there. He was playing with Peyton Manning in the Pro-Am and looking pretty good, I have to say. Looking fit and strong again. So we'll see how he gets on this week. Should be a good litmus test as to how things may go at Pebble Beach. Also on this weekend, the Belgian knockout on the European Tour. So we'll chat about all that next week, I'm sure. Now from Mo Norman.
What's the master move in golf, Mo?
My vertical drop and a horizontal tug.
That's the master move?
Right here. First foot comes straight down. The club is going further behind my back on my downswing. This is pointing. My left arm's way higher than my right. Way higher. You can always put the club in this way. Never, you know, the other way. That would fall there. My club would always fall. Never in front of me. Always back behind me. Here's a master move. The feeling of greatness. I'm the only golfer in the world who's got the feeling of greatness. The only one living. Feeling of greatness. Right here. Oh, is that pure? Ooh. I don't believe in hip turn. Shoulder turn, not hip. My hips hardly turn at all. But my shoulders turn. That's another reason why I hit it so straight. And but main reason, that's why I hit it so solid every time. There's no hip movement. My hips can never pull me off the ball. Like most people do. Watch. Just as pure as a driven signal. But big thing, no effort. No effort. No effort at all.
I'm kind of talking to most of you on the assumption that you're pretty familiar with Mo Norman. He's a famous figure in golf, despite never winning a PGA Tour title, despite never winning a major. You'll have come across him on YouTube, I'm sure. He was, by all accounts, the most ridiculous ball striker. We'll hear more about that in a moment. And a complicated person, too. The easy assumption is he was autistic or somewhere on the autistic spectrum. Certainly struggled in his interactions with people and found life in front of crowds quite tricky when it came to golf and the PGA Tour. Maybe wasn't made feel overly welcome on the PGA Tour as well, as we'll hear. Played in the Masters twice, but really spent the vast majority of his time on the Canadian tours, where he was more comfortable. He won 55 times there, won the amateur championship there twice. There is this mystique about Norman. There is this sense of unfulfilled potential. What did we actually have in our hands here? A genius, perhaps. His own very unorthodox swing is quite something. The thing about Norman is that Tiger Woods said only two players in the history of the game fully owned their swing. Ben Hogan and Mo Norman. The extent of his ball striking is probably hard for us to even appreciate, because we see these grainy YouTube videos where, again, he's quirking and he's repeating himself. He's got this weird accent, and the swing looks, frankly, horrific. You know, it's just a mad-looking swing, and yet the results seem to have been truly astounding. The man to talk to here about Mo Norman was always going to be Lauren Rubenstein. Lauren Rubenstein is a Golf Hall of Fame writer in Canada. He's written numerous books, including Mo and Me, Encounters with Mo Norman, Golf's Mysterious Genius. Lauren first met Mo Norman when Lauren was 13 years of age, and Mo Norman was in the golf club near Toronto hitting these bullet-perfect shots and entertaining everyone with the clinics. So he knew him a long time, and he had Mo Norman's trust, which was not the case with many journalists, as you can imagine. So earlier on, I spoke with Lauren, very good with his time. We appreciate it. The book, again, is called Mo and Me, Encounters with Mo Norman, Golf's Mysterious Genius. And I started off by reassuring Lauren Rubenstein that he was very much in the presence of golf nerds here, and that most of our listeners would probably have come across Mo on YouTube at some stage. And I said it often struck me that it was a great pity that there is no shot tracer on his shots, because if us onlookers from a distance and from a different time are probably to fully appreciate Mo Norman and his golf game, then maybe experiencing, as Lauren Rubenstein did, experiencing the ball flight sounds pretty essential.
It is, yeah. He could do anything he wanted with the golf ball. I mean, we hear Tiger talking a lot about trajectory, and Mo Norman, I think that's one of the reasons Tiger was fascinated with Mo, is because he could vary his trajectory at will. And I'm talking about, you know, from seeing him since he was 13 years old, it almost seemed like he could do that a millimeter at a time. I remember watching him at an exhibition at an annual amateur tournament that opened up the season every year in Ontario here in Canada where I live. I played in that tournament, and Mo would stand on the first tee before everybody else started, and he'd say, okay, what do you want? First floor, second floor, third floor, what do you want? Right to left to right. And he would just, you know, at command, just hit these shots all the time, and it was really mesmerizing to watch. Yeah, so he had, yeah, his ball flight, it was, you know, even thrilling to watch. I know how ridiculous that sounds, but thrilling to watch ball flight, but it was, because he could vary it so much at will and with precision.
Tiger Woods has that famous quote, only two players have ever truly owned their swings, Mo Norman and Ben Hogan. That's the level of esteem in which Norman's shot-making ability is held in. You, I think, did an interview with Woods by email on this issue at one stage back in the day, and there's this amazing image in many ways of a high school student, Tiger Woods, going to the library to try and hunt out golf swings, and he came across Norman.
That's right. That's what happened. Tiger was out there in California in school in Cypress, California. He'd heard about Mo, and anyway, he went to the library. And of course, this was way before YouTube or anything like that. So he had to search him out on microfiche. He found him in the library and started looking at Mo's golf swing and what he was doing. And he just looked at it and looked at it and looked at it. And that's talking about golf nerds at the top of your show. You know, there was one golf nerd there, Tiger Woods, examining another golf nerd swing, Mo Norman, and it was almost like he was communicating with Mo just sitting there. I could picture Tiger in the library looking at my old microfiche images of Mo's golf swing.
There are some amazing quotes as well in the book and across your work from people at Titleist. Wally Uline, father of Peter, obviously, and CEO at Titleist, who talked about the genius of Norman, and towards the end of Norman's life, they seemed to pay him $5,000 a month, just so, I suppose, he didn't live out his days in poor conditions. But there was a quote from a Karen Gray, Titleist supervisor of research. And basically, Wally Uline is saying to you that he was the only golfer. I mean, when you think about this, he was the only golfer that Titleist ever tested who had zero side spin on the ball. And Karen Gray, the supervisor of research at Titleist, said, "To this day, I've never seen anything like it. I couldn't believe that he could hit shots with zero sidespin. You don't see robots with zero sidespin."
Yes, I remember Karen saying that. I think when I was writing the book and researching it, I talked to her. And no rotation at all on the golf swing except end over end over end. No side spin, as you say, Joe. And they were astounded. And they're very sophisticated equipment. And that's what I mean by saying Mo could hit the ball so straight. And, I mean, he could spin it if he wanted to in the days when the golf balls, he played all of his career in the days when the ball spun more. So it's even more kind of amazing that he was able to hit the ball like that. But yeah, you can imagine all the players that they've tested at Titleist, Joe, and Mo was the only one they saw who just hit end over end golf shots, really. And that's you would just look at it, you could fix your eyes on the spot. He said, you know, kind of the channel in the sky that he said he was going to hit the golf ball through, and you could fix your eyes on that, and whoops, in a second the golf ball would appear in that channel.
Tell us more about your conversation with Wally Uline at the 2011 Masters about Mo and about the reasons Titleist decided almost to give him a pension of sorts, $5,000 a month.
Yeah, I asked Wally if I could sit down with him at Augusta. We went into a room they had in the Augusta National Golf Club, a little room where there was all kinds of Titleist products stocked up, I guess, for the players that week, and we talked about Mo. And, you know, Wally got quite emotional talking about him. He was very sensitive to Mo's issues. I mean, we've talked so far about Mo's ability to hit the golf ball with such extreme control and accuracy. What we haven't yet discussed, and which is central to Mo, of course, is the fact that he was on to succeed at the highest levels of the game because of some of his psychological frailties. I mean, golf is not a game where you can just sit in a studio or on a range, really, and hit balls. You have to go out there and perform. And while Mo performed brilliantly in Canada, won everything in Canada except the Canadian Open, at the highest levels of the game, the 2 years he played on the American Winter Tour, because of his extreme shyness and introversion and the way he went about things, he looked funny to players. Some players laughed at him and, you know, kind of made jokes about him. He couldn't handle that, and eventually he withdrew from that. And Wally was very aware of that, and he knew that Mo had played Titleist all of his career. And he just said, you know what, he'd heard stories about Mo, you know, being a little strung out, not having money, really, in the later stages of his life. And it was at the 95, I believe, PGA Merchandise Show in Orlando, I was there, and Wally took Mo and offered him $5,000 a month for the rest of his life. So you can imagine how that made Mo feel, and it was a very generous gesture from Titleist. And I'll never forget sitting there with Wally in that Augusta National room and how emotional Wally became talking about Mo. Mo had really kind of touched his heart, you might say.
The joy of modern technology is such that people listening to us can quickly hop on to the YouTube app on their phone and have a quick glance at Mo Norman swinging a club. But for those maybe travelling or who haven't seen it for whatever reason, even the setup, I mean, we're talking, what, feet wide apart, the arms outstretched, the hands much higher than you'd see in a normal swing, no bend in the end, in the elbows. I mean, the hands weren't hanging down, they were stretched, kind of rigid out. The club head nearly a foot behind the ball, and then the action was all sorts of strange as well. he's credited with almost creating the single playing golf swing. I don't know if that's true or not, but how did he dream this up? Where did this come from?
That's the thing that's so fascinating about Mo, you know, is he never really dreamed it up. It's just that he did it instinctively. It's not like he sat around his room in the evening and thought about, what do I need to do to hit the golf ball so accurately?
Right. He's not a Bryson DeChambeau who's trying to study the physics of it.
No, not at all. He wasn't talking about vectors and, you know, the kind of thermal conditions in the air or whatever. You know, good for Bryson for doing that. That's fine. But Mo just came to it. And as you say, he just stood there with his arms outstretched. Okay, let's think about that. You want to get your arms in a position at address that they're not going to vary during the golf swing. They're not going to go out from you or they're not going to come in. So what do? You just stretch them out as far as possible and you just keep them at that. We all talk about and we've all heard about ad nauseum, take the club back low and slow. That's, at least when I was growing up, that's what so many instructors talked about, take it back low and slow, again, stretch. And what would Mo do? He'd put the club a foot 14 inches behind the ball at address and say, "Ooh, it's low, it's already low, I'm already 14 inches in my backswing, and look how low I am," and he would just start from there.
Right.
You want balance in your golf swing, so he would widen his stance so much that it looked almost absurd, but, you know, he would plant his feet as if they were in concrete and just stayed there. So all of these things he came to instinctively, and I think a lot of that was just the source of why he hit the golf ball so accurately. But I think, you know, he looked so different. There's no doubt about it. And people often have asked me over the many years, you know, well, why hasn't the Mo Norman method caught on more? Why don't more people swing like that and use that method? And people have tried. Hell, I tried myself. But, you know, you have to be willing to stand up in front of people and look so different. And Mo didn't care about that. He just did it. That's who he was. So, you know, until you're willing to do that and really stand out from the crowd in such an unusual way at address over the golf ball, you're probably not going to continue with the Mo Norman swing.
Mm. And stating the obvious here, Lauren, he never took a lesson throughout his career.
Well, when he was a kid, 12, 13, 14 years old, there was a fellow named Lloyd Tucker at the course he grew up in Kitchener, Ontario, which is about an hour west of Toronto. Lloyd took a great interest in Mo and watched him, and to his credit, really didn't, you know, do much to change Mo at all. He just said, okay, here's like a guy who's kind of a wizard of the game, and we're going to leave him like that. And this fellow Lloyd Tucker also taught some of Canada's other great amateurs, Nick Westlock and Gary Cowan, who, you know, won everything in amateur golf. So he had some real superstars there, but Mo, he just left alone. He sensed his innate genius. Yeah. But yeah, you're right after that. You know, I mean, Mo was insecure. You'll recall in the book I write about Sam Snead giving him a lesson or telling him something at the Masters. And, you know, Mo went ahead and hit way too many balls one evening, 800 golf balls, and got blisters on his hands. His hands were bleeding, and he had to walk off the golf course the next day after nine holes in the tournament because he couldn't play.
Wow. There is a mystique about Norman. And in some respects, if he had played on the PGA Tour for 15 years and won 10 tournaments and two majors, there wouldn't be that mystique. But when you combine what people have said about his ball striking with this great sense of unfulfilled potential with his personality, it all becomes incredibly compelling. What did we have in our hands here, and what potentially did we miss out? You know, there were fatal flaws, I suppose, when it comes to his golf game in some respects. So, Mo Norman, the person, did you say you first met him when he was 13?
No, when I was 13, I was a kid in Toronto, and he would hang out at a driving range near where I lived, and I would go there many evenings with my dad and see Mo, this strange guy, you know, in a 90-degree July day. He'd be standing there, you know, wearing a turtleneck, sweating head to foot, you can imagine, and, you know, my dad, I said, "Who's that?" "That's Mo Norman," my dad said, and, you know, my dad, I give him all the credit in the world for saying to me, you know, a lot of people will laugh at Mo, you'll see all kinds of people laughing at Mo, but he's a fascinating guy, and, you know, I hope you'll look at him just, you know, as a human being. And ever since that, I took a great interest in Mo. And of course, I was becoming a golf nerd, you might say, even at 13. And when I started writing, you know, 10 years later or so, I developed a good relationship, friendship with Mo. And he trusted a few writers.
Right.
And I was lucky I was one of them.
And Lauren, can you give us a sense of how he interacted with people? Because I've only ever seen him, one, either doing the clinics, or two, briefly in interview situations, and they are quite artificial environments. You don't necessarily get a true feel for a person. So, I mean, it seems he was on the autistic spectrum. It depends what physician, I presume, you talk to him. We're talking about the 1940s and 50s here in terms of trying to diagnose these things. If you were to have a conversation with Mo Norman, how does that go?
You know, it was repetitive. If you had a lot of conversations with him, you know, he would often say this, you know, same thing, maybe in different forms, and you would know it. Or when he gave talks later in his life, he got a little more comfortable in front of people. And if you heard one talk and you went to another one a week later, you would, you know, they'd be very, very similar. And he would start going and going and going and talk about the same subjects. I'm the best ball striker in the world, and so on and so forth, and talk about why. It was always interesting to see. So, you know, those are some of the ways in which, you know, perhaps he was demonstrating demonstrating his psychological liabilities. Was he autistic? I don't know. In my book, I try to argue as strongly as I can that he was never diagnosed as being autistic. It's kind of a reflex for people to say he was autistic. Mm. As you say, maybe he was on the spectrum somewhere. A lot of the things he did, I would argue that he had Asperger's, which is, you know, kind of a he had social liabilities. He wasn't that comfortable with people in crowds, but with kids, he was terrific. He was very comfortable with kids. He never felt they were judging him. He would toss them a golf ball. He would chat with them. He would, you know, kind of bang the ball around if they came to the range while he was there. But with adults, if he didn't trust you at the beginning, or if he thought you were laughing at him or you spurned him, then he may never talk to you again. And, you know, he could be a bit strange that way. There were also occasions when people have told me when he would be friendly with them one day and see them the next day, and it was as if he didn't know them. So, you know, he was, you know, I've written that golf is the game that gives loners freedom of expression, and Mo was an extreme loner. He had a few people who helped him out. I mean, Mo basically couldn't take care of his own finances. He had some people in Kitchener who watched over him, you might say, looked after him, and he needed them. You're talking about a guy who lived in a motel room, or he lived in his car, and he stashed money in his car. So, you know, he was definitely out there, and that's why there's this Mo Norman mistake, as you say.
Mm. He left home at 17. What was the family situation?
You know, the family situation really wasn't too bad. It's just he wanted to go out there and play golf. He grew up in a kind of a lower middle class home. His parents, particularly his father, didn't really encourage him in golf. They thought it was a rich man's sport, and most started caddying at a local private exclusive club. And, you know, I don't think his father was too happy he was doing that. And he hid Mo's golf clubs one time. He really didn't want Mo playing. And, but, you know, that was Mo. Mo wanted to get out, and he found this talent he had. He was good in other sports as well, but exceptional in golf. And he just wanted to play. So, again, this instinct of his to kind of chase that little ball around, that's why he left home at 17 and started playing golf and going wherever he could. He played in a lot of amateur tournaments, obviously, won most of them, including the Canadian Amateur, and eventually turned pro and did well in Canada. But
yeah.
It's just seven, you know, there was nothing for him to do. He wasn't going to stay in school, so he might as well go play golf.
Yeah. To give the stats, he won back-to-back Canadian amateur championships in 1955 and 1956, and ultimately would win 55 Canadian Tour events. Two Masters appearances in 56 and 57. You've mentioned the blister situation, which caused him to miss the cut in one of those years. And then on the PGA Tour, according to the PGA Tour stats, we're talking about 1959, played 27 total events, 25 cuts made, one top 10 finish, and seven top 25 finishes. And you mentioned maybe bullying might be too strong a word, but certainly this sense of unease he would have had. And look, it's a tough school out there. He wouldn't have been the first or last guy to have felt unwelcome. Do you suspect there was jealousy in that, or was it just his personality?
I think the PGA Tour then was, you know, it was such a kind of a, even maybe more so than now, a conservative place. I mean, you've got this guy who looks so strange coming out there. It's really the heyday of Arnold Palmer, flashy, you know, Arnold Palmer, and everybody loved Arnie, of course, and Mo was the counterpoint to that, really kind of looked a little strange. He didn't, although this was the time, you know, really before the PGA Tour was on television everywhere you looked, for hours and hours a week. Still, you know, they felt that Mo was kind of harming the developing image of the PGA Tour, clean cut, you know, sport and so on and so forth. And there's Mo out there looking so strange. A certain amount of players didn't like that, and they would laugh at him. Mo would hit golf balls off of the top. He would use a Coke bottle as a tee and pick the ball off of there. And they thought he was making a mockery of the game. And I don't want to say that they ran him off the tour because it was Mo's decision to leave, but he couldn't handle the ways in which he sensed that he was being laughed at and kind of encouraged in more than subtle ways to get the hell out of there. And at one point, that was it. Mo had it, and he left and went to see a friend of his, a Canadian friend of his, a pro who was spending the winters in Florida, see him and said, you know, I'm done. His friends wanted him to go back down and out there, but that just wasn't going to happen. You know, Mo really felt that he was cast aside, and for years and years and years, he talked about that, and that was it for him on the American Tour.
What a pity. Could you imagine nowadays he would be a superstar?
You know, nowadays I think there'd be Mo Norman clubs. There'd be, you know, all kinds of people following him closely. Yeah. I mean, there back then there were small groups. But you're right. I mean, you've got Mo Norman aficionados. There's a film which is getting closer to being completed about Mo. You know, there's kind of a Mo Norman renaissance right now. Yeah. Books have been, besides mine, written on his approach to swinging the golf club, and he is a source of wonder. That's for sure. Not only Tiger, but other great balls, Bryson DeChambeau for one, Nick Price. I've talked a lot to Nick about Mo. And the guys who, you know, if when Mo was around, players would watch. They would just want to see how Mo did it. And inevitably, you know, you felt like you wanted to try it yourself. So, but you're so right, Joe. Right now, if he were around, he'd be an object of not only curious attention, and he wouldn't be really laughed at. People would be studying him. He'd be on film. They'd be examining him. And if he could handle it, he'd be on Golf Channel, all these sorts of things.
Yeah, he'd be a poster boy for inclusivity and beating the odds. It would be an entirely different experience. Quite often the great ball strikers don't love the putter or don't love chipping or the short game. I was reading Mo played exceptionally fast. Like, he mightn't even, as you know, geez, I play with amateurs who take their time over putts. He mightn't even line them up.
Yeah, I mean, he was really a fast player. I write in the book about a tournament I caddied in back there in his hometown, the Canadian PGA Championship. And let's say Mo was teeing off at 10-12, for argument's sake, whatever it was. You know, it's 10-11, and he's not there. It's 10 and 11 and a half, and he's not there. Finally, he strolls up on the tee, puts the ball on the tee, hits it, and scampers off down the first fairway. That's just the way Mo was. He didn't want to be in front of people for too long, so he would just get up there a second before it was his turn, and he hit the ball. And on the putting green, he was the same way. I mean, he'd often putt while other guys, if he was on a different line, another golfer's ball was rolling to the hole. People have often contended that Mo would have putted a lot better had he taken more time. I totally disagree with that. I mean, I saw Mo make all sorts of putts by not thinking about it, you know, just standing up and hitting it, sensing the line with his feet or whatever came into his mind. You know, at the same time, I also saw him miss a lot of short putts that maybe if he looked at a little bit more closely, he might have made them. Who knows? But I would say, and I argue that he made as many putts by kind of paying no attention to them, at least the kind of attention that we think of as being conventional to putters, as he did studying them. So, you know, I really think it was kind of a wash, as many putts as he made. That's and he missed putts as well. So who knows? You just don't know. There's so many questions about the guy.
No, it's true. We're talking here with Lauren Rubenstein, who wrote Mo and Me. Did Mo marry Lauren? Did he have children? Did he live out his days happily?
I would say he lived out his days with a great deal of satisfaction in terms of he knew he was much more accepted by the golf world. He was doing clinics for the Canadian PGA. There was a sense of kind of quiet calmness about him, you might say. But no, he never married. I mean, he had nephews and nieces. As far as, you know, people, some of his close friends would try to introduce him to some women. As far as that goes, one time he said, as far as, you know, going out with the women and taking it as far as he might have, he said, ooh, tried it once, didn't like it. And that was it for Mo. You know, you never really saw, you know, Mo hanging out with women or, you know, going to clubs or bars or, hey, let's see who's playing at the local jazz club. Yeah. You never know who I might run into. That wasn't Mo. He retreated to his motel room, drank his 20 Cokes a day or whatever until he switched to Diet Coke and sat there and, you know, kind of held the golf club in his hand. And if you happen to, one time when we were doing a documentary for CBC here in Canada, knocked on his door, his motel room door, and he answered, you know, holding a driver in his hand, fashioning the grip end in his underwear. And that was his life. You know, he was just hanging out there. You know, he wanted to be left alone unless he was comfortable with you. And those with whom he felt comfortable could get a lot of his attention. But, you know, I mean, he was a lonely figure. You know, there was certainly a high degree of sadness, except, as I write, and I'm convinced of this, he did what he wanted to do with his life. He hit that golf ball. How many people, Joe, really do exactly what they want to do every day of their lives, every minute of their lives? And maybe it wasn't the way we would live in our lives, but Mo hit that golf ball thousands and thousands of times often in one day, played some tournaments, a lot of tournaments in Canada, and he did exactly what he wanted to do, try to control the flight of the golf ball. That's all he ever wanted to do.
It's a great way to finish, really. When did you last see him? He passed away in 2004.
He passed away in 2004, and I saw him, you know, not long before that. Unfortunately, I couldn't go to the funeral because it was the same week as the Canadian Open, and that happened to be the one. I used to caddy on the PGA Tour, and now I was caddying in that Canadian Open for a friend of mine, and it was going to be the last tournament I caddied. And that was the week that Mo passed away, and they flew the flag at half mast. And but I couldn't attend the funeral, which was too bad.
Sure, but hey, I guess if you're a friend to someone all their life, then turn up their funeral. I'm sure there were people there who could have been nicer to him, so it doesn't really matter ultimately.
No, you're right. I mean, Mo had his close group of friends, as I say, close group of people who cared about him, and they cared deeply about him, and they helped him out. And, you know, he lived to be 75, and he did what he wanted to do with his life, which is, you know, pretty damn good.
It sure is. Listen, fascinating. Mo Norman, so Mo and Me, Encounters with Mo Norman, Golf's Mysterious Genius is the book. It's out a couple of years now. Lauren Rubenstein, who's written many books, you can get hold of that. Hey, just one last postscript to all this, because you were the guy a couple of years ago who got the big exclusive with Tiger Woods. I remember the time. It was a big deal. Penny, for your thoughts now as we look back at that time when it looked fairly ominous for him, and then, hey presto, he rocks up at Augusta.
Yeah, you know, I will say that from the time I spent with Tiger for that interview in Time magazine as he was approaching his 40th birthday, and then I, you know, helped him with his book on the 97 Masters 20 years later, people would often ask me in the intervening period between that and when he won the Masters, do you think he could win again? And most people just, you know, as you know, just didn't believe he had a chance of winning again. And all I would say to them was, look, from sitting there with Mo, with Tiger for hours and hours and hours, I can tell how much he wants to get out there, compete again, win again, but it will all depend on his physical health. If he can get back his physical health and he gets in position, particularly at a major, he will remember how to win, just as Jack did in 1986. He remembered how to win at 46. And I said, you know, I see no reason Tiger can't win again if he's physically healthy. If he's not physically healthy, forget about it, you know. But, you know, we know what happened a few months ago, and we'll see what happens at next week's at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, well, your point still stands. The body holds up. Who knows? Listen,
exactly.
Real pleasure to have you on. It was great to talk about Mo Norman, something a bit different. So, Lauren Rubenstein, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
You bet, Joe. Nice chatting with you. Take care.
So there you are, Lauren Rubenstein, author again of Mo and Me, Encounters with Mo Norman, Galt's Mysterious Genius. That is the podcast for today. I appreciate not the usual format, but I figured I should cobble something together. I know it's not great when we miss a couple of weeks in the trot, just one of those times, people on holidays and all that. We should be back next week in more regular formation. Until then, you can get us as ever at Golf Weekly, and we'll see you next week. Cheers.
Starter kid right here.